Right. It's my pleasure to chair our third panel where the lawyers fight back with regulating for water stewardship, being an economic agnostic, having been raised under Thatcher and had her as the first chancellor at the first university I worked at. I'm looking forward to evening the score. Okay, so our panel this afternoon are all performing without the aid of a safety net. There will be no PowerPoint, so that should give us a little bit of a smoother transition between speakers. First, can I introduce Donald McGillivray, who is now Reader of Law in Sussex Law School, having recently forsaken the grey skies of Kent for the blue skies of Sussex. And Donald is an extremely eminent environmental lawyer. He's editor, he's author, co-author of one of the main student texts in this area. My students worship him as a god. He doesn't know this, but it's true. And he also works with William Haworth on water pollution and water quality law. And is an associate editor of the Journal of Environmental Law, and water law is one of his many areas of expertise. And rather than eat into his time by eulogising further, I shall let him go for it.
Thank you very much for that very kind introduction. This paper was originally titled The Water Framework Directive and Water Rights, Private Rights, Public Responsibilities and the Challenge of Stewardship. But partly last night and partly over the course of this morning, I wondered whether I really need to reshape it, because we've heard quite a lot about stewardship, some very good discussion about stewardship, and I wanted to use my time to partly shift the focus a little bit towards socio-legal scholarship. So in place of stewardship, delete stewardship and place socio-legal scholarship. So what I'm going to try to do is to think about the way in which the Water Framework Directive has impacted on water rights in the UK and what this may have to tell us about socio-legal analysis and what socio-legal analysis can help tell us about these changes. Because you've all just had lunch and you're probably very sleepy, I thought I'd also start out with a little thought experiment, partly just to amuse myself. One of the provisions I'm going to be talking about has been alluded to earlier in a couple of talks. It's called Section 27 of the Water Act 2003. But before I talk about that, I want to just ask the question, just on a straight show of hands, the extent to which people think it is right or wrong that abstractors should have to give up their license or have their license varied if that's to protect serious damage to the environment. So just by, you know, regardless of what the law is or isn't at the moment, do you think it is right or wrong that abstractors, without compensation, should have to give up their abstraction rights in order to prevent serious environmental damage? If you do, stick up your hand. Yeah? And if you don't?
Well, I think they should give them up with compensation.
Okay. So, yes. So I should have said, yes. If you think they should be compensated for that instead of not being compensated... Yeah?
Yes.
So,
give them up but compensate.
Give them up but compensate. Okay, so a couple of compensators and everyone else is with the legislator on that. Okay. Thank you for indulging me. Okay.
Is there a payback on this?
There's no payback. Okay, so... Yeah. Okay, so my paper is essentially structured as follows. I want to look a little bit at the historic common law background to water rights. Then I want to say a little bit about the Water Framework Directive and then how that's applied to water rights, in particular under this provision in the Water Act 2003. And then I want to try to really just ask some questions about what this might say in terms of a socio-legal analysis of water rights. excuse me. In terms of the socio-legal analysis, I want to suggest essentially that there's a distinction between, if you like, the classics of the literature in terms of socio-legal environmental law analysis, which have tended to look at the ordinary and the routine and the everyday or relatively everyday activities like water pollution or health and safety at work offences and so on, and the provision which I'm going to talk about, which is more exceptional. and which probably has got more in common with some other types of environmental law provisions like we have in relation to things like contaminated land, where we're trying to look for exceptional environmental problems and then respond to them, rather than necessarily look at everyday problems, although I appreciate that it depends how these things are framed. If there's time, I'll maybe get on to thinking about some issues about rights and regulation. As Bettina alluded to, I think she was using Bronwyn Morgan's work. Where's Bettina? Yeah, Bronwyn Morgan's work on the contextual relationship between rights and regulation. That might not have time to do that in the paper, but maybe that can come out in the discussion. Okay, so the first part of the talk is just a few words about the common law background. Now, Karen introduced that and made the distinction between ordinary and reasonable use, and I don't need to go over that. What I do need to say is that that reasonable use approach was only really settled in the English courts in the early to mid Victorian period. The leading case is a case called Embry and Owen, which is from 1851. The decision in there can be traced back to a decision of the King's Bench in 1833 in a case called Mason and Hill. And the important thing is that that marked a distinction between an approach which was, until that point, unclear as to whether we should take a prior appropriation or first-in-time approach. This is our Chinatown example, California. Or whether the common law should take a reasonable user approach. And essentially what the English courts did in Embry was to settle on the reasonable user approach, which Josh Getzler from Oxford says left Waterlaw in a state inviting intuitive ad hoc decision making. So I think it's very important background is that there's a sort of sense of pragmatism that law is really just providing the conditions within which riparian owners, not necessarily just bargain in the shadow of the law, but the law provides a very loose framework within which that bargaining process takes place. As Getzler says, the law was the third party enforcer of norms, where the norms themselves were set by the interacting parties. So we're not talking about hard and fast rules. I got here first. This is my claim. You can just hang. Okay. So in other words, what Getzler is saying in his fantastic analysis is that the problem of allocating common water resources was resolved, as he puts it, by private treaty and custom, assisted by law. So law plays a backup role rather than a dominant role in that sense. And if we had time to go on to look at the implications of that, I think they're quite significant in terms of rights and regulation and stewardship, because it's emphasising the correlative nature of the right rather than its absolute nature. It's emphasising the reasonableness of the right as opposed to its absolute quality and so on. Okay, so that's the background. Okay, the second part of the paper is to look at the Water Framework Directive. I think most of us here probably got a fairly good appreciation of that, but just by way of a quick skim over that, the Water Framework Directive, as we know, has the main environmental objective of aiming to achieve, as was put out, the objective aiming to achieve good surface water status, good ecological potential, and good groundwater status. And as was rightly pointed out, there is a distinction between no deterioration, which seems to be an absolute obligation, and the obligation to aim to achieve the environmental objectives, which are couched in different language. It's not clear that I don't think I would go as far as you did in terms of their aspirational quality, but I think there is a distinction. I think it's certainly true that they are ambiguous objectives. But I think one of the very interesting things about the directive is that the ambiguity of the obligation, it doesn't seem at this point to be so much of a barrier to the directive being something which is influencing behaviour on the ground. I think if you talk to people who work in this sector in terms of the agency and rivers trusts and abstractors and so on, the Water Framework Directive clearly is seen now as the key driver It doesn't completely exclude other directives which are in play, but in terms of general water management, clearly it's the central driver. Now, we could say more about the legal status of these objectives, but I'm not going to at this point. What I would say is that in terms of national implementation, what we've done is simply copy out the obligation into our national law, so we haven't really tried to more specifically define what that objective is. Although as a matter of national policy, the UK government talks about the default objective of achieving these things by 2015, but then also it talks about the alternative objectives which relate to reliance on the various exemptions and feasibility issues and cost factors and so on, which might delay the attainment of those objectives until 2027. So effectively, what's happening on the ground is essentially three phases of implementation. So we've got implementation up to 2015, but a very generous view, I think, taken that you know we can go up to 2021 and then up to 2027 before things are going to get hot in terms of fines, I think. Now, this degree of uncertainty, I think, is important because the Water Framework Directive already, as we'll see, is a driver for specific measures which are being used to address, or which could be used to address, chronic forms of environmental damage. So one of the difficulties with the directive is because of its ambiguous obligations, it's very difficult for it to be used in a linking way in terms of other drivers for behavioural change. So, for example, one of the issues that's being debated in Brussels at the moment is the extent to which the Framework Directive can be used in a cross-compliance way. It's quite difficult to say to a farmer, you must be in compliance with the Water Framework Directive because of the ambiguities of what that means. No? No? I thought you were going to come in and correct me on that point. That's certainly my interpretation of that. So I think the same is true of other. It's not just a problem with the EU water law. It's also a problem with other things like general waste management objectives and so on. Okay. So there's lots of complicating factors about the Water Framework Directive, but I want to comment on two more positive things, if you like. In terms of the directive's innovations, in terms of, as we've heard, about river basin management, and also in terms of its requirement that the public has the opportunity to be involved in the formulation of these river basin plans, which marks a departure from the UK's historic approach, which has been much more technocratic and, in a sense, more corporatist. I think these two aspects, the planning and the public involvement, have come together in catchment planning, and as I said in my question in the morning session, there was a legal challenge brought by WWF UK and the Angling Trust against the UK government on the grounds that there was too low a level of ambition in implementing the directive, and that claim for judicial review was withdrawn when DEFRA announced measures to strengthen implementation. DEFRA issued an 8-page statement outlining this agreement, saying, and I quote, "more action is desirable at catchment level." So it can be argued that the catchment approach that we now have in at pilot level in a number of pilot areas is in part a result of that process. Okay, specifically in terms of quantity, the Framework Directive, I think, is clearly important because it's the first piece of EU legislation to specifically address water quantity issues. And this is important partly because, of course, water quantity affects water quality. But it's also important, I think, because of the extent to which the aims of the directive may be conceived of in not just narrow ecological terms, but also extending to advancing recreational interests, which may rely on a sufficient quality of water. Although I think there's some doubt about that point, the directive is not terribly upfront about saying what the underlying reasons for its being are. It talks about its environmental objectives. It's not clear whether those are in order to improve water quality for the sake of the water, for the sake of the river, for the sake of us, in the sake of trying to reduce costs to water companies, integrated catchment, ecosystem services, recreational benefits, user, non-user benefits, and so on. There's a degree of ambiguity, I think, about that. Nevertheless, in England and Wales, it's estimated about 4% of rivers are failing to support framework directive good status, good ecological status, due to pressures from over-abstraction. And further stretches of river are failing to meet good status because of obstructions to things like fish passage. And addressing these is seen to be necessary to comply with the framework directive. So we need, although my focus is typically about abstraction, we need to think about abstraction and impounding. Excuse me. Okay. As I said, I want to look specifically at one provision of the Water Act, which is Section 27. And the context for this, we've talked about it a little bit before lunch, is the approach that's been taken to historic abstractions, which were treated very generously when statutory abstraction rights came in 1965. These were given licenses of right, effectively permanent license, based on their prior use. And as we saw, although the 2003 Act moves away from a time-limited approach, it didn't change the time-limited approach in terms of those historic licenses. So we still have licenses which have been granted on the permanent basis. The view of government at the time, or at least just prior to the 2003 Act, seemed to be that it would use economic incentive mechanisms to try to persuade abstractors to move from permanent licenses to time-limited ones. There's a government white paper in 1999 which states that very clearly. In fact, it says, government remains of the view that truly responsible abstractors should have little need of persuasion that voluntary conversion is an essential ingredient of their environmental credentials. Although it was interesting that that line of argument had disappeared by 2001 and doesn't seem to have reappeared. In fact, it was formally rejected by government in 2008, when the abstraction charging system was reformed, where essentially there was a much greater sense that incentive charging would need to be used. Funds would have to be accumulated through charging and then paid out in order to compensate. Okay. Right, I'm conscious of time. Section 27 very briefly says it removes the right to compensation where a licence granted before the 1st of April 2006 and which is not time limited is varied or revoked as directed by the Secretary of State on or after the 15th of July to protect the water environment as that is broadly defined from serious damage. Which the guidance indicates includes the potential or risk of serious damage. In other words, it is intended to be a brake before we hit the wall with our car that's speeding and not just a measure that applies once we hit it. Now, we might ask, what's the purpose of this provision? It comes into on the statute book in 2003. It only comes into force in 2012. And I want to raise some questions about that. I think one answer to that may be maybe found in the review of consents which took place under the Habitats Directive, which was supposed to be completed by 2010, under which abstraction rights were being compensated fully. And so it was possibly seen as a way in which not to cut across the compensation which was being given, which, as far as I can work out, potentially ran to hundreds of millions of pounds for things like Natura 2000 sites and also national nature sites. But we might also think about this term in terms of whether it has driven behavioural change, whether it's effectively been a measure where we say to abstractors, you have 9 years in which to reform your abstraction practice, after which you know what to expect. Okay, what would a socio-legal analysis of this provision look like? As I said, we might think about it in terms of whether it has been able to force behavioural change. It's certainly had a very generous lead in time, which might suggest that that was intended. Although, when we look at the consultation on the bringing into force of, oh, sorry, the consultation which took place in 2012, there doesn't seem to be any great urgency if the consultation is taking place in February 2012, 4 months before the provision is about to become effective, in terms of at that point defining what serious damage is. It doesn't seem to be setting the rules of the game in 2003 so that people know what the rules of the game are that they have to change by 2012. It seems to be a law of a different kind, simply saying, okay, oh right, the rules are changing in 2012, we better explain how we're going to use this provision. So in other words, there doesn't seem to be much of a forcing aspect to it. And I think that's actually somewhat regrettable. Because one of the other things that we might say is, you know, we've talked about water resources and grandfathering. We've said that license of right are a grandfathering measure. This is almost a sort of grandfathering within grandfathering, another 9 years. But one of the criticisms of grandfathering clearly is that it's not terribly helpful in terms of driving dynamic efficiency. Alice, you talked about dynamic efficiency. One thing perhaps for discussion, I don't think we've heard enough about dynamic efficiency in the morning session in terms of that being a justification for reforms that we might put in place. We've heard a lot about why markets might be attractive, but not whether they would deliver efficiency reforms. Okay, so just to conclude in terms of this potential sociological critique, as I said before, you know, my approach to sociolegal studies has been highly influenced by the work of people like Keith Hawkins and Bridget Hutter, who've worked here at Oxford and who've looked at things like routine enforcement, prosecution of water pollution, health and safety offences, and so on. I want to suggest that maybe we've got a provision here which we might look at in a similar kind of way, but looked at as a more exceptional provision, and to see whether some of the insights which Hawkins and Hutter and others drew from their work in terms of the moral and political ambivalence of the law, how that applies where provisions are much more exceptional. And I think there's maybe a lot to be said about some of the practical difficulties in terms of what we've heard about, the difficulties of understanding the water cycle, you know, whether we could ever really make a provision like this stick, and if it is going to be used, how some of those debates all come together. Thank you.
Thank you, Donald. Exactly to time as well, through frantic waving. Right. Next, we have Professor Bill Howarth to speak to us. He's Professor of Environmental Law at the University of Kent, and for anyone who knows anything about water law, he is Mr. Waterlaw UK. There is no one who knows more about this subject than he does.
Very careful.
I think we can say that with complete confidence, and lawyers don't generally make unqualified claims. Bill is, amongst the many other things he does, general editor of the Journal of Water Law. He's written extensively on water law, and he's advised on the practicalities of water law all over the world. Basically, if he hasn't advised you, you're not worth advising, from what I can see from the list. So stand well back, enjoy.
I think I shall need a few moments to recover from the introduction. It's very kind of you to say all that, and I'm sure what follows will be a disappointment after it. I want to talk about the right to water security. Note the difference of emphasis there, not the right to water, the right to water security and what it might mean and the extent which there is or should be such a right. But I want to set that in a broader, more general context by starting to say something about the general objectives that we should be seeking to manage in relation to the water environment. Well, the starting point for any discussion of things environmental is the idea of sustainable development. I have nothing useful to say about that. I'm not quite sure I've grasped it. I'm not the only one, but maybe you're not so honest about that. But the idea is that the very secondary principles like precaution, prevention, and making polluters pay, which are means to this end. And in the water context, I think that the counterpart of those ideas is the idea of integrated water resource management. It's got the same kind of pedigree. It derives from the Rio conference in 1992, Agenda 21, problems of scarcity, destruction, pollution, so on and so forth, all the problems of the water environment demand integrated water resources planning and management. The problem is, like with sustainable development, it's not actually defined what that means. So it's not until a few years later that there's a technical advisory group that tells us what it is that is being demanded. It's a process which involves the coordinated development and management of water, land and related resources, whatever they may be, in order to maximise the resultant economic and social welfare in an equitable manner without comprising the sustainability of vital ecosystems. It sounds very much like this ought to be a good thing to me. Integration is one of those wonderfully value-laden words, maybe one of the most deceptive words in the English language. I do sometimes wonder about whether integration of one thing means disintegration of other things. But the idea is somehow we can quantify economic, social and environmental goods, and the recipe for maximising the aggregate of those things is integrated water resource management. And as with sustainable development, disagreeing with that is some kind of environmental heresy. Whether we understand it or not is a different matter, but let's just play ball with this for a while. So if integrated water resources management is the object of the exercise, a part of that is to do with the integration of administrations, the integration of regulation of water, perhaps. You can see where we're leading to. Is it the idea that there should be some kind of codification of all the law which relates to water, and this is the most integrated approach? With that in mind, I started looking at national legislation on water. Not a very thoroughly or scholarly survey, but I pressed the button on Westlaw, which gave me all the statutes which have water in their title, and I got 2 pages worth of statutes. These are just UK primary acts concerning water. I didn't go into the secondary legislation or the sub-jurisdictions. I didn't go for all the other terms that I could have used, but you get a general sense of the picture. UK water legislation is a model of disintegration. What about the European Union? Well, we've heard all the rhetoric about the Water Framework Directive consolidating, providing a holistic body of legislation on water. Is that true? Well, there's been a recent document issued by the European Commission, well, last year, a blueprint to safeguard Europe's waters. And in 20 pages... it's the most wonderfully concise summary of just how unintegrated European Union law is. Alongside the Water Directive, we have separate legislation concerned with urban wastewater, nitrates, industrial emissions, bathing water, drinking water, not part of the water framework setup, various appendages concerning flooding. But the bigger problems for water are about things which don't actually come under that heading. It's activities to do with medicines, pesticides, veterinary medicines, and what arguably is the most important directive in relation to the aquatic environment, the REACH directive, about the control of chemicals. Arguably, I think that could be at least as important as all the water-specific legislation. And we go through these 20 pages, and the idea is that we have disintegration across the board, particularly in relation to the common agricultural policy, but another of other sectoral concerns. So we're not scoring very highly on the integration stakes, either at national or European Union level, which gets me wondering, well, is this really a suitable approach? Why is it that water legislation is so fragmented, or we start thinking about the different purposes for which we might want to regulate water. And okay, broadly we can think about a utilitarian reason for regulating to benefit either present people or, who knows, future generations might come into the utilitarian calculation. Or you can think about the intrinsic value of water, water environments, ecosystems, and the need to regulate to protect those things regardless of whether there's any benefit through ecosystems or something of that kind. And then you start to think about the different uses to which water is put, even under utilitarian heading. And I like to divide these into consumptive and non-consumptive uses, but I do accept that that's very much a matter of degree. We might start thinking about water for domestic, industrial and agricultural uses. The more consumptive uses, you think about water for dispersal of waste, for hydropower, for navigation, fisheries, and indeed recreational uses. And the imperative is that somehow or other, all these different things are integrated. I find that really rather unhelpful. I see these uses as essentially competitive. It's about making difficult decisions as to which of these uses should prevail. And the call for integration simply serves to mask what I think are inevitably controversial questions about which of these things are most important. From that, I'm also conscious of another distinction in water legislation, which I think is a deep-seated human predisposition towards water. It's an ambivalence towards water. On the one hand, we're trying to protect water from humans. On the other hand, we're trying to protect humans from water. There are various contexts where it's not so much about safeguarding water, as the European Commission would have it, but it's about water as a threat. So I say, well, we have water which is hydrophilial and hydrophobic in the sense that it is a threat. And the two aspects of this, where the water is in deficit and where water is in excess. And what better time to be talking about this after 2012, the extremities of weather we've had. Lord Chris Smith was on the Today programme earlier this month, saying that one in 5 days in 2012 saw flooding, while one in 4 days saw drought, with massive implications for agriculture. Yes, and there was another, actually very good report by the Institution of Civil Engineers, The State of the Nation Water, which was published, I think, slightly before it started raining. And they rated UK water security as about 4 on a scale of 1 to 10. Why was that? Because of the lack of action to address water shortages and water supply issues. And I think the very useful recognition of the fact that the UK is not water self-sufficient. It's a common myth. But we now appreciate the role of what's called virtual water. That's to say, water which is used to produce the food we buy, the goods we buy, manufactured or grown in other countries. In effect, we're making use of their water supplies to meet our national needs. We're 75% dependent on imported water in products. So what is this showing? Well, maybe that the extremes are becoming the norm. It's an uncomfortable kind of thought, and I don't want to get into the question of why that is. I mean, I appreciate some people would love to say climate change, end of discussion, but many people are very much more guarded about whether particular events can be related to climate change. But I think these two things have something in common. They're both causes of water security, and maybe there are analogies to be drawn in the way that they're regulated. So just turning to the legal side of stuff, what has been happening in this up to the present act, the Water Act 2003 sets in place what I think is quite an important process of water resource management planning. It puts an obligation upon water companies to produce reports which say how they will meet water needs over the next 25 years. It's not about short-term planning, it's a very much longer horizon. An explicit process to show that they've properly considered all the options. And it's been pretty controversial, this insofar as we've had two public inquiries concerning Thames and South East Water, who've been trying to fiddle the process in order to provide justifications for reservoir building. Thankfully, they've been found out and told to think again about these projects. There are better ways of meeting water demands over that period than what is being suggested. But I think it's interesting to see this as a sort of risk-related forward-planning approach to ways that we can meet water needs. Regrettable, some might say, and I'd probably be amongst them, this is left to private commercial bodies to do rather than public sector bodies. Nevertheless, we have a public inquiry system which we can call them to account if they choose to use it for commercial gain. And on the other side of things, the water excess problem, we've had the Flood and Water Management Act of 2010, which I think also shows a pretty radical change of thinking. Before 2010, we had something called flood defence. The idea was the public bodies had powers to defend land about against flooding. After 2010, the new concept is about flood risk management, and this seems to involve a recognition that preventing flooding at one location might involve increasing flooding at another, and that this should be a new approach. But I think both of them recognise human frailty in the face of natural or semi-natural caused events involving the under or over abundance of water. Turning to the point I wanted to emphasise, does it make sense to talk about a right to water security? I bear in mind that rights are rights of and against human beings. To an extent, and I'm not going to say what that extent is, what we're talking here about here is rights against nature. And that, I think, puts it into a different category. What is the best response to matters which, in part, at the very least, have a natural cause? Well, in the flooding area, we've got two very good role models. The first one is King Canute. The English king or king of England and Denmark shortly before the Norman conquest. And according to the apocryphal version of the story, he had his throne placed on the beach and he ordered the waves to recede. They didn't, and he got his feet wet. One version, this shows the humility of kings against the power of gods and nature. In the version which is to be adopted by generations of civil engineers, we build ever higher embankments and eventually we can stop the waves coming forward. The other role model is Dr. Foster, who in the children's nursery rhyme went to Gloucester, stepped in a puddle right up to his middle, not very good rhyme there, and never went there again. And this is the idea of managed retreat. Yes, there's certain facts of nature about which we can do nothing. We should be avoiding confrontation with nature. We should be looking for solutions which are most natural in that respect. And I do feel that some of the new legislation paves the way for that. What should we be doing about water deficit? Well, emphasising not just the need for expanding resources, building more reservoirs, but looking at controls upon demand of water, and particularly in things like that abstraction reduction has been mentioned, but water metering is something which could be pushed forward a lot faster than it is, and perhaps even accepting water availability as a constraint upon development and growth. No, I hear the government saying, no way, but this is something that I would say is a serious consideration. In relation to water excess, look at sustainability of defences. Maybe think about transferring some of our resources to restoring floodplains rather than building ever greater defences, more sustainable drainage systems, and avoiding any development in flood-prone locations. I know we've reduced it greatly, but 260 developments a year in the floodplain, I still feel is too many. So my conclusion... Well, if there is a right to water security, it strikes me that it's a highly qualified kind of right which recognises the limitations of human action in the face of gifts, or as they may be, curses of nature. Within that recognition, nonetheless, I do feel that there is more that could be done to enhance water security, either in relation to drought or in relation to flooding. Okay?
Perfect.
Thank you.
Thank you. Right, our last panellist in this session is Dr. Sarah Hendry, who is located at the UNESCO Centre for Water Law, Policy and Science in the University of Dundee, which is one of the globe's, not just the UK's, leading research centres in water and the interdisciplinary issues that water actually involves. To complete our set, Sarah is the Scottish editor for the Journal of Water Law, and she also sits on the Scottish Customer Forum, which is a body designed to represent consumer interests in price setting for water services, which is something we've sort of hedged around a bit this morning but haven't really had the chance to think about. Now, Scottish water law, certainly in the 19th century, was regarded by the English judiciary with envy as... being far in advance of anything that we managed in the light of the Industrial Revolution. Sarah will see, bring us up to date with what we can envy now.
Thank you, Karen. And it's my pleasure to be here. It's always lovely to come and talk about Scots water law. When Mark first suggested to me that I should come and talk on private rights and public responsibilities, I thought, what an interesting topic. Where would you start? And in terms of modern Scots law, the place to start is 1999. But we will go a little further back, with a nod to what's been said already on riparianism. Because it's true, we can trace the Scottish courts' development of what you might call classical riparianism as opposed to reasonable use back to 1624, no less, in Bannatyne and Cranston, which was commented on favourably in both the House of Lords and in the American courts for its development of the doctrine without using the name. Also in that earlier period, my all-time favourite piece of case law, the Mayor of Berwick against Haining, where the court declared that Providence, in its wisdom, had placed the great rivers on the face of the planet to carry man's filth to the sea. So, yeah. But times move on, and by the 19th century, when the riparian doctrine was being refined in Scotland and in England, we hear that properly no man has a right to pollute. So we're already seeing two important distinctions there, I think, between public and private rivers, and also slightly different approaches to pollution on the one hand, and the other rights in water, abstraction, diversion, impoundment, river works. Moving rapidly through the 19th and into the 20th century, we see the refinement of riparianism, but it's still very much private right against private right. That's really the context for many of the decisions. But as we move through the 19th century, we see also, and coming back to water services, that transfer of water rights away from private landowners to a variety of corporations, boards, municipalities for public water supply. And that, I think, is an important part of the trend from private right to public responsibilities. As we move through the 20th century and into the second half of the 20th century, we've heard some comments today about UK water law. I would hasten to say there is no such thing as UK water law. In water, much more so than other parts of the environment, water was always distinct. It was part of private law, protected under the Treaty of Union, developed not wholly differently, but distinctively nonetheless. And apart from, I think, the very first Prevention of Pollution Act, thenceforth Westminster always legislated separately for Scotland, which was fine when they had time to do that. By the 1970s, they no longer had time, and they tagged bits of Scottish reform onto English acts, miscellaneous provision acts, and so forth. So, 1999, new Scottish Parliament. Happy confluence of timing, I think, because the Water Framework Directive's going through. There's people from SEPA working in Brussels on the Framework Directive, and all sorts of opportunities presenting themselves for Scotland to do things slightly differently to the way they might have been done at UK level. And the Scottish Parliament has been very focused on water, not just in terms of the Framework Directive, a whole series of inquiries and a whole series of acts, 2002, 2003, 2005, 2009, 2013. I tell my international students that once their parliament has had a good look at water, it won't go back there for at least 10 years, probably several decades, but that's not been true for us. So that process started off with the transposition of the framework. Well, no, that's not quite true. The Water Industry Act on the services side came first, and there is a success story around the public delivery of water services in Scotland, but not for today. In terms of the Framework Directive, the 2003 Act, primary legislation first of all, and primary legislation on the statute books in April with the December transposition deadline. So I think that in itself is evidence of the keenness of the Parliament to take this agenda forward. So lots of things new for us. We had no river basin planning really to speak of in Scotland, and we had no comprehensive abstraction controls either. We controlled public supply, big hydro schemes, but the majority of landowners were still free to abstract water and use it, including for secondary purposes subject to their downstream neighbours, and certainly from groundwater, very much a property-based right. And the courts would have told us in the late 19th century that it was a right of use as nearly amounts to property. But nearly and not quite. Water is always different, is it not? It's res publicae, it's jus commune, it's roots in Roman law. Always that recognition that water rights are a little different. So along with the things we had to do for the Framework Directive, we also did a lot of things we didn't have to do. You could call it gold plating or a job well done. But we completely revised our domestic water law, and we brought in a set of regulations, controlled activities regulations, which managed all uses of the water environment, abstraction, discharge, impoundments and river works under the one control regime. And that's a tiered system with general rules at the bottom, registration and licences at the top. And without a doubt then, somebody who prior to that might have thought that they had a property right in water, and certainly in groundwater, all of a sudden found that they were controlled, they were subject to rules, they might need a licence and to pay a charge for that. And one of the heartening things was that those rules were not challenged on human rights grounds, not even by groundwater abstractors. So I think they took a long, hard look and they said, this is legitimate, this is proportionate, we're not going to get very far, we won't challenge it. The next piece of legislation was the Water Services Act, which again isn't really relevant to us today. But the one after that's the Floods Act, and that transposed the Floods Directive. But it also did one or two other interesting things. Again, gold plating or just making sure that all necessary provisions were in force. The Floods Act requires SEPA to identify natural features and characteristics that might be relevant for flood management. And what they're talking about here is floodplains, wetlands, forests, upstream flood control. And the implication of that is that the private landowner might be asked to give up some sacrificial land for flood management to benefit downstream. And I think we're still waiting to see the nature and extent of compensation that might be put in place to facilitate that. Along with that, SEPA is also required to identify artificial features that have an impact on flood management, and that might be weirs or other structures. And tied into those artificial structures is another provision that hasn't been brought into force yet, but will be. We will see new regulation shortly, allowing the allowing SEPA, allowing the state, if you like, to require landowners to either restore or remove structures in rivers that might be impacting negatively, not just on flooding, but on other morphological issues in terms of achieving the framework directive. So we already have a river restoration programme which will pay landowners to carry out morphological alterations, but these provisions will be compulsory powers. Most recently, the Water Resources Act. So recent that I don't think it's had its royal assent yet, but it's completed all its parliamentary processes. And the Water Resources Act is a curious mishmash of things, but one or two of those things, well, three of those things, in fact, might be interesting today. At the very start of the Act, there's a brand new shiny duty on the Scottish ministers to develop the value of Scotland's water resources. And value was defined in the bill as being economic or other value. We've got a lot of objections. Those of us who gave evidence to the Parliamentary Committee urged the committee to do something radical. We suggested a duty to take an ecosystems approach, or even a requirement to recognise the inherent value of water in its natural state. The committee did not go that far. But they did, though, agree, rather grudgingly, I think, to put environmental and social, along with economic, into the definition of value. A great many things in this most recent bill are concerned with the Scottish Government's so-called hydronation agenda. Again, fascinating, but not really for discussion today. But next up in the bill was a new provision that had not been consulted on, and that was to give the Scottish ministers additional controls over large-scale abstractions. And because it hadn't been consulted on, we didn't really know why it was there. We have a really good system for controlling abstractions through these controlled activities regulations. But depending on who you talk to and when you talk to them, it is either to enable government to facilitate bulk transfer of water out of Scotland, or to enable government to prevent bulk transfer of water out of Scotland. I think once the engineering and the environmental issues with bulk transfers have been solved, the government will then realise there are political dimensions to that as well. The last thing in that new bill that I'd like to mention, and I'm close to the end, the last thing that I'd like to mention is a provision that relates to Scottish Water, allowing Scottish Water to enter into catchment management agreements with landholders who have sources of drinking water within their landholdings. Now, of course, Scottish Water is a corporate entity and can enter into agreements anyway in relation to their core business. But this is to strengthen the provision around catchment management, and also some compulsory powers here as well. So Scottish Water will be able to enter into land and take samples for monitoring quality purposes that they didn't necessarily have before. And that has also raised some concerns amongst the landholders and the land managers in question. Scottish Water are running a pilot scheme at the moment around these catchment management agreements, where they will pay relatively small sums of money to farmers and other land managers in order to improve their agricultural practice. Now, one of the things we did under the CAR regulations was to legislate for diffuse pollution, and not many countries have chosen to go down that route. But we took a set of minimum standards out of the Code of Agricultural Good Practice, and we said, well, we'll enshrine these in legislation, we'll effectively make it criminal offences not to comply. Sorts of interesting enforcement questions there. So clearly it's extremely important to make sure that the water services provider, on the one hand, is not incentivising farmers to do things that the environmental regulator says they have to do anyway. So the kind of things that will be incentivised under these catchment management agreements go a little bit beyond the mandatory basic rules. So essentially, that's a system for payment for ecosystem services. And I was quite surprised we haven't heard more about that terminology today, because I suspect it is another name for a market mechanism. It certainly is a market mechanism. At the moment in Scotland, it's very popular with the policymakers, but I think very rapidly it will become more popular with the farmers and the land managers, who will maybe see this as a way of validating their claims for compensation for things such as giving up land for floodplains, for example, or doing additional work to prevent diffuse pollution. So That ecosystems debate, that ecosystems approach, if you like, to land management, I think is something we're going to hear a lot more about. And it might provide a way through that complex maze of banning on the one hand and subsidising on the other. Or it may not in fact prove to do that. So, in conclusion, we've seen a great deal of very rapid lawmaking in Scotland. What we've not seen is an unequivocal or explicit statement that water is in the public domain. Who owns the water? Well, we prefer to keep that quite quiet in the UK. We would say that landowners have some rights or others have some rights. There has been certainly over hundreds of years and then very rapidly in the last 15 years a huge shift from private rights to public responsibilities on behalf of those lucky enough to hold land with water within it. And I did just wonder when I was thinking about today and what to say today, if another analysis that we might think about is a shift from private rights to public rights. Because essentially the Water Framework Directive puts water in the public domain. And in most continental European countries, it will be explicitly in the public domain. And although we don't go that far here, and we haven't in Scotland either, essentially I think that is the impact of the legislation, that we no longer expect to have ownership rights, property rights over water. We recognise that it will be controlled for the wider good through some kind of legislative scheme.
Thank you. Right, well, I'm sure we'd like to thank our speakers in the usual way.